The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
When you were a country singer out on the road, opening for Leanne Rimes and Travis Tritt, did you ever think about lentils?
I probably had a couple of bowls of lentil soup, but I never would have guessed that lentils would become such a central focus of my life.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Liz Carlisle. Liz is a fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems at the University of California, Berkeley. She's a native of Missoula, Montana, a former country singer, and before graduate school, she served as legislative correspondent for agriculture and natural resources in the office of United States Senator John Tester. We're here to talk about her book, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. What is the lentil underground? How did you get involved, and why did you write a book about it?
The lentil underground is a name I came up with for an organic farming movement in Montana. And it got started in the 1980s, but its roots are really quite a bit deeper in the grain pools, really, that our grandparents started in the early 20th century when they first realized that corporate agriculture was destroying their communities in many ways, and that they didn't have the power in that system as it became more and more concentrated to determine their own futures. And I got involved, so I was a country singer, and I realized as I was speaking with farmers that I met along my travels that things were really rough in farm country, that the industrial food system was making it really tough to be a farmer. And I went to work for John Tester. That inspired me to try to work on some of those policy challenges. So I was working for John Tester 2008-2009. I was a legislative correspondent, and I was hearing from a number of people who were acquainted with him who were fellow organic farmers. And I realized that this was a farmer science movement. This was an incredible grassroots upswelling of change in the food system from my own home state. And I wanted to learn more about it.
And you are from Montana.
I am from Missoula.
Well, let's go back to what you said about corporate agriculture destroying community. Explain that a little more.
Yeah. So this starts as far back as the early 20th century, even before that, that agriculture was consolidating. We think of ourselves as a nation of small farmers. That's the Jeffersonian ideal, and really what our system of government was built on and our idea of how our democracy functions. But starting at that time, at the turn of the 20th century, grain processing, marketing, sort of the purse strings in the agricultural system started to get concentrated, funded by bankers out of New York, and really became more of a corporate industry. And farmers were getting the short end of the stick, of course, and they were sort of increasingly getting channeled into, there's only one elevator you can send your product to, it's going to go out on the railroad car, and these corporations were dictating what the price was going to be. And as the 20th century went forward, they were also dictating what was the seed variety that was going to get planted, which herbicides did you need to spray, which fertilizers did you need to use. And so the lion's share of farming in terms of acreage became much more like factory work in a way, that where a lot of the parameters were dictated by corporations. But farmers, being the famously independent people that they are, have resisted that.
It sounds like the mono transportation was part of the problem.
Absolutely. Mm. Infrastructure was set up around this industrial model. And that's why it has taken not just individual farmers who want to be organic and resist that model, but an entire lentil underground, because you need a number of people to rebuild infrastructure around a model that's about regenerative economy and keeping some of that money in the local food system and thinking about both the people and the environment and less about the profits for the shareholders, which is, you know, obviously the only thing really at the end of the day that those corporations are responsible to.
And then there was a time, I think it was 1971 to 1976, where Earl Butz was the Secretary of Agriculture. And it seemed like that really messed things up, his policies.
Yeah. Earl Butz was a powerful figure, and I think he voiced this productivist paradigm in a way that did move those policies forward at an alarmingly fast rate at that point in our country's history. Two of the things he's most famous for saying is telling farmers they should plant fence row to fence row and get big or get out. And so his vision of agriculture was that it would scale up as far as possible and that that would be economically beneficial. And if you didn't want to farm at that scale, that you should do something else. And what we've learned, of course, after proceeding along that policy is that that doesn't last very long. It may appear on a year-to-year basis that you can make more money that way or produce more grain that way, but we saw just tremendous amounts of soil erosion in the 1980s, and that's what inspired these kinds of movements, because people literally could no longer farm their place in that way, and if they didn't make a change, they were going to go bankrupt, their farm was going to become unproductive. And then we have the diet-related disease, of course, associated with that form of farming and the types of products that are being farmed that way.
And the problems with our water system because of the fertilizer, dead zones in the Gulf and things like that.
Exactly right. Yeah, nitrogen fertilizer is a huge problem locally in terms of that nitrogen in the groundwater and water quality in rural communities, and then it's a huge problem at a larger scale with the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's a huge climate problem. You know, basically the largest culprit, when you look at the greenhouse gas emissions associated with our food system, it's manufacture of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. So that's why I got so fired up about the Lentil Underground and these crops that are fixing nitrogen biologically. They can pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere, work with symbiotic bacteria, provide that nitrogen to the root zone as fertilizer, not only for themselves, but the following crop. So to me, if you want to think about how do we change the climate footprint of agriculture, what better way than these nitrogen-fixing crops that can get us away from synthetic nitrogen fertilizer?
There's something called food miles that says, you know, it takes traveling back and forth to get our food from wherever it was grown back to us. I mean, it could have been grown right down the road, but it's got to go be processed and then distributed through a grocery chain and come back to us. But in your book, you suggest that the issue is more complicated than that.
Yes. Yeah. A study came out in 2007 that calculated where do the greenhouse gas emissions come from that are part of the average American diet. And they found that transportation to the final point of sale, food miles, accounts for 4% of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the average American diet, a pretty small slice of the pie. 11% if you look at transportation overall throughout the entire supply chain, so when it's going from the farm to the distributor, perhaps inputs coming to the farm. But the really big chunk is actually what's happening on the farm. How is the farmer farming? And a big part of that is what inputs is the farmer using? If you've seen a graph that shows how much carbon emissions come from eating beef or other types of meat, the main part of why those are so high is actually the grain that's grown to feed the animal. And it's the nitrogen fertilizer that's used on the grain that feeds the animal. So, yeah, I've been encouraging people to think beyond food miles, and this is part of this sort of food citizenship idea, is really getting to know what practices farmers are using that you're patronizing.
The young man who started Timeless in central Montana came back after college and wanted to be on his family's farm, but there was this huge process to go from the chemical fertilizers to nitrogen-producing lentils, and it's been going on for decades. It seems like such a long process. I'm surprised that they survived it.
Yeah. Well, I just have all the admiration in the world for David Oyen, for his compatriots in the Alternative Energy Resource Organization, and the other founders of Timeless, the folks who were trying to figure out how to do organic agriculture in Montana in the 1980s. Because what they were doing for the most part is they were reading about what people were doing in other parts of the world and how to build a biological system on the farm and then trying to adapt that to their setting, because Montana, central Montana, doesn't get a lot of rain. It has a short growing season. So that was the reason for lentils, is they're a cool season legume and you can farm them dry land. You don't need any irrigation. But they were reading about things. They were reading Miguel Altieri from the University of California, Berkeley, who was working in Latin America with the milpa system, with intercrops of corn, bean, and squash. So, you know, that was the legume in that environment. And they were literally looking around in the barrow pits at the side of the road to see, are there legumes growing here? You know, what works here? What's growing natively? And the first legume that they experimented with as a cover crop was something that their neighbors thought of as a lawn weed. Well, so clearly it survives well here. But then there was the challenge of perception and the challenge of, you got to live in the same community with these people. They're small towns. And, you know, are you going to get a loan from the bank? Well, maybe not. So you got to ask your friends and family. And just, you know, the everyday people driving by, that looks like a weedy field. It was a tough road to hoe. But I think once organics really started to arrive in the 1990s on the consumer side, and people began to see this is a viable business model, it started to change the perception in those communities about being an organic farmer from something that was really kooky and radical to, hey, maybe this is the way that we can pass these farms on to the next generation.
Well, there were people in the book who just had to get to the point of bankruptcy before they would make any changes. So I think there were all kinds of pressures.
Yeah. David Oyen talks a lot about the necessary and the possible. And you got to the point where it was necessary to convert to organic. And it was pretty clear that there was no other path. So, you know, how is this possible? So, yeah, people got to the point where it was either stop farming or find a way to farm without chemicals.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Liz Carlisle about her book, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. If you tuned in late or you would like to share this program with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. It's also posted at our Facebook page and on Twitter. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about the tangle of government agencies involved in the production and distribution of our food, and we'll find out what happened to the lentils during the hot, hot summer of 2012. Don't go away. Thank you. the number of government agencies involved in the production of our food is just absolutely mind-boggling. I was trying to take notes as I read the book, but, you know, I have an entire page full of acronyms, and I still don't think I got all of them. Some people in Montana like to think of themselves as rugged individualists. They don't want any government interference, but it seems like a conundrum to me because those same people are collecting checks when their crops get hailed out or something, and they're collecting them from government agencies.
Yeah, it's true. At our food and farming sector, the government has always been extremely involved with it. It's true across the world because food is important and land use is important. Those are both really key public goods, and we don't want to just let the market figure out how to distribute them because it's morally reprehensible to us that people should go hungry. Now, of course, they do. So our food and farm policy is obviously a failure. But that has been the case since the beginning of our history as a nation, that the federal government has been involved. Look at the Homestead Act. That was a direct subsidy in land to farmers with the idea that it would benefit the country. And I don't think it's a bad idea for the government to be involved in food and agriculture. And the beautiful thing about being in a democracy is that hopefully we can explain to our representatives and work through our representative government to make that food and farm system serve the public interest.
I certainly want somebody overseeing the quality of the food that gets delivered to my store.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, speaking of government, which is really synonymous with paperwork when you say a government bureaucracy, it takes years and years and reams of paper to move a piece of land from regular practices to organic. And everybody that did that in Central Montana had to go through all of that. What kind of stories did you hear about those processes?
Yeah. Well, luckily, it's getting a little bit easier now. The Natural Resources Conservation Service of the USDA, they've been putting a lot more energy into helping farmers transition from conventional to organic. So there are more resources available than there were at the time that these folks got started. So there's all the challenges of figuring out this new form of production if you're not using chemicals for weed management. Got to learn how to do it mechanically and biologically. Your soil is going to kind of go into shock if you're not applying fertilizers after applying them for years and years, and to rebuild the biology of that soil, soil structure, soil organic matter. There's all those challenges. And then it's a 3-year transition period legally before you can market any of your crops as organic because there's going to be residence time in the soil of the chemicals that were used previously. So that's a challenge because you're paying the fee to be organic and you're doing the paperwork and you're doing kind of all the extra due diligence and probably some extra tillage if you're not using chemical herbicides, but you're not getting the premium yet. So that's a difficult time, that 3-year transition period.
And what your neighbors do can have an impact on your status as well.
Right. Yeah. Some folks have had those issues with herbicide drift. And with GMO drift, and of course GMO isn't allowed under the organic program either. We don't have GMO corn or soybean very much in Montana, a little bit of corn in eastern Montana. GMO alfalfa, however, is a concern for this group of producers.
The summer of 2012, I remember well, was blazing hot. And I didn't keep up on it directly, but I think wheat and corn had problems. They dried up in the field and weren't able to be harvested. So what happened to the lentils?
This group of producers had an amazing story in 2012, and it really surprised me. I was doing my research with them, and I was nervous that actually the research would be totally for naught. That essentially, oops, I came in a historic drought year and none of this great stuff is really going to pan out. But the wonderful thing about organic farming with rotations, when you build your soil and your soil organic matter, it has more water holding capacity. So the soil can actually store more of the water from previous rains when a drought period comes. And that's what happened to a number of these producers. And across this lentil harvest, all the producers who grow for timeless natural food, they only got about 40% of the average moisture that they would normally get in the season, but they still realized 80% of their yields. And the quality was so high that economically, they didn't take any financial hit, which was just an extraordinary story for that particular season when so many farmers basically didn't get anything.
Lost their crops and had to apply for insurance and subsidies.
Yeah.
You know, when I heard about a book about lentils, I thought, okay, well, I try to present a wide variety of topics, but lentils. But I have to say, 260-some pages, I really enjoyed reading this book. But the part I liked best is your conclusion that nothing happens without community. And I'd like you to read just a few paragraphs from the section titled, You Can't Do It Alone.
Sure. Much like a newly initiated legume farmer, I want to think that lentils are a straightforward substitute for synthetic fertilizer, a cheaper, more environmentally benign alternative. To some extent, this is true. But if that was really all there was to it, there would be no lentil underground. Just a smattering of savvy growers rationally applying plant-based nitrogen instead of expensive ammonium nitrate. But the fact is that biological fertility is more than just a different nutrient management approach. It's an entirely different way of life, one in which time and space broaden considerably, and the illusion of control falls apart. Building your soil biologically is not a precise prescription for a particular crop, but a contribution to a larger ecology, subject to independent variables, geologic time, and global biogeochemical cycles. You will not capture all the value on this farm in this year. You cannot individualize your return. To build biological fertility is to build community, to accept interdependence with other creatures and foster a common benefit. This way of life cultivates a new kind of awareness, a new empathy. You have to pay attention beyond this homestead. You have to pay attention beyond this season. You cannot spray and then forget about it and go to the lake. Planting organic lentils and all the other crops that go with them becomes part of who you are, what you are conscious of, how you see the world. It forces you to listen more deeply, more expansively. And it softens, to some extent, the borders of the self. This is the great irony of the lentil underground, or perhaps its secret. What rugged individualism brought together, only community can sustain. When I'd asked Casey Bailey to reflect on the biggest lesson he'd learned by bucking the corporate farm industry, he paused for a full 10 seconds, then answered firmly, that you can't do it alone. This Montana lentil harvest is no fairy tale success, but a complicated saga of adaptation, learning, and even some hard times. The story of Timeless Seeds is not a heroic one, but then again, these fragile plains are not a place that needs heroes. What I'd tell beginning farmers who want to do this, Anna Jones Crabtree told me, is yes, believe in yourself, but also every season you learn something new, and every season you adjust and rework your plan. People like Anna don't tend to make headlines as organic industry leaders, because their aim is not runaway success, but resilience. Anna and her fellow Timeless growers attempt to create a workable niche for themselves in the food system while simultaneously questioning the very foundations of that system. By finding creative ways to stay in the game without fully accepting its rules, the lentil underground alters the landscape slowly, subtly, subversively. This is why they can withstand challenges that bring the rest of American agriculture to its knees, like the 2012 drought. Instead of building farming systems that are maximally productive under ideal conditions, they're designing dynamic agroecosystems for the long haul, which can both survive adverse conditions and adapt to them. The many dimensions of the lentil underground, from the diverse community of microorganisms beneath the surface of the soil to the diverse community of people organizing for change beneath the surface of Red State America, are at the root of this supple strength. This is not the strength of the mythological Westerner who can outcompete all rivals. This is the strength of generations of real Westerners who know how to work together to weather life's storms. In a world made increasingly volatile by climate change, this is the kind of strength we need.
If you were queen of the world, how would you tell people to buy their food?
I would tell people to grow their food if they can. And if you cannot grow your own food, get to know your farmer.
Did you write a song about lentils? Have you ever sung about lentils?
No, but we have a wonderful YouTube video on the Lentil Underground website from a member of Food Corps. You might know about Food Corps. It's a food-specific AmeriCorps that was innovated in Montana, is now nationwide, and a woman from Food Corps, Ronan, has in fact written the lentil song. And she performs it in this YouTube video, complete with hand motions. It's part of a curriculum project for second graders. But when I put the sort of level on the website, I said for second graders and all of our inner child.
Excellent. I'll put a link to it on the Right Question blog. Liz Carlisle lives in Berkeley, California. You'll find more information about her and her writing, as well as a link to the lentil song at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, links to our podcast, Facebook, and Twitter pages. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Osteen, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.